Like I said, we've been continuing our series through Hebrews, and today's the last message that I'll be giving on Hebrews. Maybe not this year, but at least this series. Next week, I'll be focusing a little bit more on Jesus and his faith in action. And this passage in today's talk is on the challenge of faith. And one of the big challenges of faith is being able to persist even though you don't know where the end is. And so this is a picture of, you know what this is? It's a metaphor. Anyone take a guess? The light at the end of the tunnel. Yes, the light is the darkness destroying the light. The darkness pushing the light further away. That's Jason's interpretation. Yeah, and Josh. Nice to know our generation of non-cynical people is continuing. It's the light at the end of the tunnel. And the more I thought about what this light is, the light at the tunnel, it is the purpose or the reason that we press on. You know, if you're going through a really difficult time, you keep going because you're like, I know at the end this will be okay. Or I just have to get to that finish and then we can go on to the next thing. I think my wife and I, there's been a lot of conversations about her work this year. She just keeps saying, don't worry, once I finish this, it'll be all better. You know, I won't be so busy anymore. And I keep saying, I don't think that's the way work works. But if that's the light at your end of your tunnel, keep going. Actually, I think the problem is sometimes this light at the end of the tunnel, if you don't know what that purpose is or you don't know what that real anchor is, it can get kind of depressing. And so I think for a lot of people, this is the way we feel right now. Due to budget cuts, the light at the end of the tunnel has been turned off. And I know for a lot of you guys in your working environments, I'm shooting a laser right in my eye. Oh my goodness, there's the light at the end of that tunnel. There's the sense of due to budget cuts, actual budget cuts in your workplaces, the light at the end of the tunnel is getting dimmer and dimmer because you are being more and more overworked. You're more and more tired. You have more and more fear and uncertainty about what's actually going to happen in anything you're working in, especially in the public sector. And that becomes very difficult because when you lose your point or you lose the purpose of why you're doing something, it can get really depressing. My friend, when he was studying for his A-levels, his heart was set on going to Oxford. And he worked so hard and he did very well and he tried so hard to get to Oxford and then he didn't get in. And that's like the light at the end of the tunnel was switched off. And he lost all purpose and lost hope. What's the point? Why go to any university now if I can't go to Oxford? And in the end, he had to go to Sheffield, which in the end worked out much better because Sheffield turned out, you know, academically, they're like on par, right? But at least there he met his wife and eventually they moved to something else. The questions for us when we talk about this light at the end of the tunnel is, what is the point or what's the purpose? And it's a question that actually we don't ask enough in our own lives. Or when we do, we don't know where it ends. So if I ask you, you know, what's the purpose of your life? You'll be like, oh, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll quote the catechism, to enjoy God and to know God and enjoy him forever. But if I break it down a little bit further, if I ask you, what's the point of your job? What's the purpose of your job? For a lot of you guys, it'll be, well, to pay the bills, to have income. What's the purpose of your marriage? What's the point of your marriage? To have kids, I guess. I don't know. To be happy. And you have to ask that between you and your spouse. What's the point of having your kids? To provide for you in the future? There's no guarantee that's going to happen. What's the point of some of your friendships? What's the point of things? And you understand when you start asking that question too much, you start asking, well, what's the point of coming to church? And one question that I know a lot of us ask sometimes is, well, what's the point of coming to church? What's the point of believing in God? What does this matter? When you're going through a very dark time, these questions come again. When you're suffering a long-term illness, or you're facing death, or you're not sure what's going to happen, you'll ask, well, what's the point of going on anymore? My grandfather, who got older and older, started saying, what's the point of me being alive? All my friends, I can count them on one hand now. I should just die now. Like, for him, what was the point of living? The challenge for us is we need to figure out what is the point, what is the purpose. That on the first hand, what is the overarching purpose for our life, for existence? Because if we understand that, it can reframe all those other things. You understand, like, if your purpose really is to know God and enjoy Him forever, that also becomes the purpose of your marriage, or the purpose of your children, or the purpose of your work. Right? If your greatest desire is to really know God and enjoy Him, well, that's why I'm married. So that through this, I will know God more, I will love Him more, and I will practice that love and knowledge of God with this partner of mine. That's why I have this family. That's why I have these friends. That's why I have this job. That's why I don't have a job right now, but I'm looking for a job. And now I have to turn around because my fly is open. La, 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 la. Thank you, Jason. I'll tell you the story of Kang. One time I was preaching and my shirt button was open. And as I was preaching, Kang, sitting in the front row, just leaned forward and buttoned my shirt and then sat back down. That was when we were in the small building. And he did that because Christina Tang, sitting in the back, texted him and said, "Can you button Bert's shirt? It's bothering me." It's good to know that I am a pastor full of respect and fear. Moving on after that story. When we look at our concept of faith and the things we've been talking about, we have to understand that actually our faith here has a purpose. It is not meaningless. Loving God, knowing Him, not just coming to church, but actually knowing and loving God is full of purpose. When we look at this verse, and we'll start off with Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." See, the opening point to this is Jesus' death was not meaningless. His coming to earth was not meaningless. He had a very clear purpose and a very clear reason. But more than that, if He perseveres and if He endures and if He does all this, He does that to demonstrate, hey, those of you who feel hopeless or feel lost or feel confused, don't give up. Because at the end of the day, Jesus has persevered through everything. Do you understand? He is our eternal hope. So even if you are lost or you are confused or you feel hopeless, there's this picture of the, you know what though? Jesus died for a reason and He rose again for a reason. So why am I giving up when I know Jesus persevered to the very end? It is this picture that gives us a purpose to persevere, to go through any dark time. At the end of Hebrews chapter 11, it starts talking about people who were persecuted or beheaded or killed. And they never lost hope. They never lost faith. Now, I'm asking you, if you are faced with death and someone's going to kill you, isn't that, where's the light at the end of the tunnel there? You know, you're not going to escape. You're not going to be able to get out. You're just trapped. Where's the light at the end of the tunnel? Unless Christ is that light, you are going to lose hope. You will fall into despair and misery. And you have to say, well, actually, the power to persevere, the ability to persevere, is in knowing that actually Christ, He is the answer. He is the light at the end of the tunnel. The first point is really Christ's death is not meaningless, which means following Him is also not meaningless. In our lives, there will be a lot of distractions, a lot of things that cloud our perspective of what's important. These are the things which seem to weigh in more importantly than other things. One of the things that always bothers me is sometimes when I get really busy, my brain gets clouded. I lose track of things. I forget things. I leave the car unlocked outside my house, or I leave the front door unlocked. I'm so busy focusing on other stuff that I forget things. I think my wife one time left the gas on the stove with no flame because she had forgotten, or else she was trying to kill me. It's one of those two. But it's this thing where you become so clouded with other things that you are unable to know what is real or what is important anymore. And yet this verse says, since we are surrounded by this cloud of witnesses, you understand there should be a different thing that surrounds us, that surrounds our minds, surrounds our thinking, surrounds our relationships all the time. It's this picture of these witnesses. And what are these witnesses? It is this crowd of people who have gone before us, who have persevered, who have endured, who have not given up because they knew what was most important was Christ. And if Christ got through this, whatever difficulty you are going through is not hopeless or pointless, but you can get through that too. So when we talk about things like marriage, if your marriage is going through a very difficult part, there's this understanding that actually, Christ, your desire for marriage is for this marriage to be reconciled, for there to be the demonstration of love and forgiveness in this. So my hope is in you. My promise is in you. So I press forward in that. If it's in your struggle against sin and you feel like just giving up, there's this hope that says, actually, no, but Christ, you have overcome this, so I press on because I am not afraid. It's this picture where you say, you are looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. This is great because it tells us that Jesus isn't just sitting at the end of the finish line waiting for you to get there, but rather he established it and he is perfecting it along the way. You are getting better at your faith because of Jesus, and you are looking to him because he is the one who has established it. If I give you a picture of it, it is most traditionally used in this thing is a picture of this marathon, this running, this great cloud of witnesses who are running alongside. And there's two things in this. There's those who are running alongside us now to give us hope and encouragement. When we talk about the Egyptians, the Coptic Egyptian Christians who suffer persecution yet don't give up on Christ, that gives us hope and encouragement. When we hear about the church in Croatia and hear about those six people who are baptized, it gives us hope to realize, actually, God, you are greater. There is great stuff happening. When we hear about different things happening in our own church, it is like, yeah, okay, why should I give up, Lord, if you are continuing to show your goodness all around? The biggest part of this is it takes the focus off all the troubles that you feel like you might have and opens your eyes to how great and good and powerful God is. And he can lead you forward even in this dark time. In our society, we get very used to just focusing on ourselves, wallowing in our own misery, looking for things to try to appease us. And this passage is saying, look, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, take your eyes off yourself, but you begin to run. Just join them in running this race because you know there is a light at the end of the tunnel and that light is Christ. If your situation seems hopeless now, where do you need to put your hope? If your situation seems hopeless, where do you need to put your hope? If you can find out where that is, sorry, my family's waving to me. My wife was so incensed about that comment, she just left. No, just they're going to a wedding in Oxford. So they're off. Okay, bye, kids. This sermon's all over the place today, isn't it? Okay, the second thing is actually not just faith to persevere, but the faith to grow. When we talk about, and we look further in this passage, actually this idea of growth is this idea of being able to be more resilient, to have endurance, to have strength. Now, this is where the passage turns from being something just encouraging to getting a little bit more toughening. Let's read on, Hebrews chapter 12, verses 3 to 6. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons, for what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now, actually, something we don't talk about very often is the discipline of God, God's discipline on us, God's discipline in our lives. But actually, what it's saying is the discipline of God is very good. It's very useful. It's very important, actually. In fact, it says, if God did not discipline you, it means he doesn't care. He doesn't love you. You would be illegitimate. In other words, he doesn't care what happens to you because you're not his children. Now, this becomes a challenge because depending on your family, the discipline that we've experienced is painful, physically painful, illegal in this country, questionable tactics using shame and guilt and fear. And then we begin to think, oh, if that's the only discipline I kind of know and understand, is that what God's discipline is? And then we think, oh, yeah, maybe that means when I feel shame in church, that's what it's about. Or maybe I just need to beat myself up more because that's the kind of discipline we learned when we were growing up. What's important is that we have to understand that there is a difference between God's discipline and man's discipline. See, the difference is mankind, we are sinful. Even though we might have good intentions, the way we do it may not always be good. Our parents' love for us to work hard and to get good jobs and try to make money is good intentioned, but the methodology behind it may not have the wisdom that God has. We have to understand God's discipline. His perfect discipline is firm, yet true, decisive, yet not done out of vengeance or malice or anger. Man's discipline might be done out of spite or out of having a bad day or out of drunkenness or out of fear, or out of shame from their own past. I know so many times my parents, when they were mad at each other, they would shout at us. I remember one time I got mad at my son, Alex, and the first thing he said was, okay, I'm going to go do some work right now. Completely unrelated to anything I was mad at him for, and yet the first thing he ran off to do was to do some maths. Because he thought, well, that will make up for my wrongdoing. I'm like, oh no, I've become that Chinese dad. How did that happen? You understand, even though my intentions have always been good, it means because I am fallible and I am human, it doesn't come out correctly. God's discipline is different. And we have to figure out how do we react to God's discipline. Now let me ask you, well, what is God's discipline? Does he like shoot a lightning bolt from the sky and like burn something? No, rather, it seems like in this passage, what it's suggesting is you will be put in situations which challenge you, which test you, which make things difficult. And instead of just trying to avoid those things or run away from them, rather endure and persevere and look to Christ, because it is in that situation that you are learning how to become more, how to love God more. See, in our society, what we want is we want things easy. We want things automated. We want things where we don't have to struggle. But actually, when you find that you can persevere and overcome a struggle, you come out at the other side greater or better, or you learn more. Having children has been one of those struggles that I have learned to enjoy. We used to argue about who had to clean the house or who had to wash the dishes, but now nobody argues about that because we would rather do those things than have to hang out with our children. It sounds bad. It does, but sometimes you're so tired. In fact, yesterday, my son was talking to me, and I was just zoned out, and I was not listening to him at all. And then when I went to sleep, I felt really convicted. I realized, God, actually, I am just brushing off this challenge by just acting in my own selfishness. But really, my responsibility is to listen to him, to even pastor him, to bless him in that way. And I told my wife, oh, it's going to be so hard. Sometimes I'm so tired. I don't want to have time. I have to listen to all these other people. I don't want to come home. And then I realized, no, that's how you grow. The Lord's discipline is also joyful. You are put in situations that are also challenging and yet can be very joyful, especially as you persevere and go through them. The picture that I have to kind of explain this, and I think the word that I think you use is better than discipline, because I think for a lot of us, the word discipline has a lot of violent negative connotations. Rather is corrections. The corrections that God wants to make in your life or in your attitude are different. Now, if you've seen this, for some of you, this may be the most painful thing you see. You've written an essay and you've asked someone to look over it, and it's come back with all these red marks on it and also this beautiful thing on the side called track changes. And the more track changes you see, the more depressed you get, especially if you're writing a PhD or a paper or whatever. Don't worry, this is not the plagiarism thing, which would put you in really bad things, but rather it's just saying these would make it better. Now, how you respond to criticism reveals a lot about where you are as a person, where you are emotionally, spiritually, mentally. And so when we begin to say, actually, God, I invite you, can you show me what corrections I need to make in my life? And it's not a debatable kind of correction where he says, well, I think you should use the word this here, and you think, well, I disagree with you. But rather God is saying, no, actually, the corrections that I'm making, they are valuable, they are true. For me, it was this understanding that in my head, I need to switch on the switch that says track changes so that I can look at my life and look at my day. At the end of the day, I can look at it and say, oh, actually, whoa, there are a lot of changes that I could have made in my day, and I need to implement them tomorrow. God, will you show the corrections I need to make in my life, the edits that need to be put there so that it can come out clearer? The question is, what correction is God making in your life? And what changes do you need to have tracked? The last point is this, that actually God's faith, the faith that we have as God, is a faith for holiness or to do what is right. The passage goes on in verse 12. It says, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone, for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. And it's this picture of actually what sounds like is someone has collapsed on the ground because they're either broken or worn out, even though they need to still move forward. And it's saying, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, right? It's this picture of someone who's collapsed at this marathon because they can't go any further. And it sounds like it's a little more than that. There's a part, maybe a sprained ankle that's lame, and they can't move any forward. And it says, make a straight path for your feet. What's that mean? It means look clearly where you need to go and move in that direction. Straight path means make it clear. And then get up and go in that direction. What jumped out to me was that part which says, but what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. See, the thing that is, what is lame, and I don't mean like, oh, that's so lame, but rather this thing that there is some injury or something in your life that is wrong, that is misplaced, but is so debilitating that you're not able to move forward. And it could be a spiritual issue. It could be an attitude. It could be sinful behavior. It could be doing something that you know is wrong, but you're too scared to confess it. What this is saying is, look, you need to see what the end game is, where you're going. And then you ask God, God, will you heal that part and remove it from me? It could be a wound from your past. It could be some bitterness with someone else. In this passage, it goes on, it could say, it could be sexual immorality. It could be bitterness. What is it that is lame that actually needs to be healed so that you can get up and walk forward? If you feel for yourself that you are stuck, that you are paralyzed somewhere, and you're waiting for someone to come along and just to help you and get going, actually, this passage is saying, wake up. Get healing for that, and then get up and start moving in that direction. And as you go, that healing will continue. This passage it's kind of pointing to this two parts of holiness. One is this holiness in our relationships. When it talks about things like bitterness or sexual immorality, it's actually saying, look, the way we treat one another should also be holy. Not self-serving, but always out of respect for someone else. Do you understand? The biggest principle that's being challenged right now today is everyone is so selfish. They say, if it feels good for me, then what's wrong with it? If this is the way I think, then why should you be allowed to challenge it? The Christian's thinking is this. Actually, we desire the best for someone else, and we want to respect them. We want to look to them, and we want to bless them instead of just forcing them to see our point of view. You understand, as you begin to respect them, then their hearts and minds will be open to discover and see where truth is. But up until then, it is just butting heads. For us, it is saying, when our holiness in our relationship means, actually, how can we become more loving and more respectful towards one another? How can we demonstrate God's love in those relationships? How can all our relationships be pure and holy? The second is personal holiness, being right in where we are and who we are ourselves. It's kind of this picture. It's on one hand, it is us helping the other person keep going, knowing where they're going, but it's only going to work if you trust each other. If you have this understanding that actually we are on the same team, that we're heading in the same direction. But both sides in this picture need to demonstrate strength and movement. The guy who's helping him up, he's not just dragging him along. The other guy has to push himself up as well. And the one on the top, he has to be anchored. He has to know where they're going. To close off with, I want to just leave with these questions. If your situation seems hopeless, where do you need to put your hope? And what you can do is you can think about the situation that you're in, whether it's your studies or your work or your future or your relationships or your family or your marriage or your children or your physical health. You just need to say, actually, God, actually, where do I need to put my hope? And if my hope is there, will you lead me through this? The second thing that I'm asking is, what correction is God making in your life? What is he saying? Actually, the Lord's discipline or the Lord's correction in this case is actually this, how you treat your spouse, how you talk to your boss, how you talk to your parents, what you do when no one's looking. Are those the corrections that need to be tracked and changed? And finally, what area do you need to strengthen in holiness? Is it the way you talk to one another? Is it your language? Is it your attitude? Is it worse? Is it the way you think about someone when they're not there? Is it your desires that aren't holy that you're asking God, will you change me? Will you make me right again? It's with these three questions that I want us to use as a time to prepare our hearts for communion. So communion is that time where we come and we remember what Christ has done for us and we receive his forgiveness and his healing. So before we do this, just take this time and say, God, actually, this is where I need correction. This is what needs changing. Use these next few minutes just to meditate, to reflect before God, and to ask him. And then just to repent and to ask for his forgiveness again before we come and take the bread and the cup. So let's be still before the Lord.